well as artists Paige and Susan. Goodness. Anyway, that's going on at the Bill Reed Gallery, and you should check that out. It's there until next February and open now. If you're an SFU student, you get free admission to the gallery. But either way, it's super affordable and an amazing exhibition that I cannot recommend enough. So go check that out. Something else you can check out happening this weekend, happening Saturday, is a Black History walking tour of Vancouver, which happens, starts out at the Vancouver Museum, the Vancouver Maritime Museum, and features a walk through some community gardens, some historical landmarks, and a great conversation led by Cor Case. So we are going to hear my conversation with Cor right about now.
Hi, my name is Cor Case. I am from Vancouver, BC. I like to call myself a social retrofitter, and I'm here with the Vancouver Museum about to do an amazing tour featuring hidden history, Black history, and as well as talking about food, land practices, and culturally relevant food specifically.
You said a cultural retrofitter?
Social retrofitter.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
I mean that I think that the work that I've done particularly has been championing and advocating for space for people of African descent. And a lot of the times when we think of spaces, a lot of times we think of, oh, maybe we need to build something new, which I do believe is important, that there's essential that we build new spaces. But what about the old spaces? How do we bring the old spaces into the future? And I think the best way we do that is through upgrading, through social retrofitting. So changing programming, creating more accessible spaces, inviting different communities, different people into space, to share in space, to commune together, and to reimagine what the future of that space could be. Because in order to make it sustainable, we need to be thinking about who is not in the room and how could it come and be present in the room. So that's kind of what I say I do. I'm a social retrofitter.
Okay. How did you come into this work?
It started off as an artist, and I was an artist looking for space in the city of Vancouver, and there's not that many spaces at that time for artists to perform or to gather. And so a few other artists within the specific African descent community started to gather and create community partnerships with other spaces. And then through that, offering programming, offering culturally relevant education, offering consulting, and it became more of a realizing that there's a lot of people and spaces that could be supported by the work that I do. And so it just became something intentionally that I wanted to do in relation to have some level of impact, I guess, within community and understanding that it's necessary. Because what I did end up finding through the journey was that there are a lot of spaces, and sometimes we don't need to build new spaces, we just find ways to utilize what we have. So it's kind of a way of being sustainable and understanding that in Vancouver there is a limited amount of space in which the city has to operate and use on, as we are on unceded territories and Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. So being mindful of how we use that space intentionally, practically, and so asking a lot of these questions kind of led me along this journey. And so this is where I'm currently at, and it's still expanding. I'm still learning every day, but I think it has allowed me to be more optimistic and also to offer something of impact to community.
You've mentioned a couple times not needing to build new spaces, but sort of reclaiming or changing or refurbishing existing spaces. Mm-hmm. What are some of those spaces that you found to reclaim?
I think a lot of the times we were focusing on a lot of institutional spaces, finding that there has been a history of systemic oppression and racism that has existed in a lot of institutional spaces. So a lot of people who find themselves racialized or marginalized don't enter those spaces for a reason. And a lot of these spaces I found systemically finding issues maintaining retention when it comes to diverse communities. And so you ask the question, well, why? And then when you start to look at the history, you start to see, well, maybe these spaces weren't made intentionally to support these individuals or to welcome them. And some of that, the remnants of that ideology still is in the space. So then how do we change that, and how do we solve that alongside, like I said, creating new spaces, but at the same time seeing how we can utilize to bring everyone forward, or at least those spaces that want to transition into something, I think, more sustainable and more welcoming to the ever-changing, expanding demographic of Canada and the world globally.
We're doing this interview in one of those institutions. Mm-hmm. What has it been like working with the Museum of Vancouver, and what has that process been?
I think the Museum of Vancouver, it's been a great opportunity to work with them. They understand the importance of creating intentional spaces and also shedding light upon diverse histories and promoting, I would like to say, reconciliation and truth and expansion and having conversations and dialogues about things that are necessary, because the truth is required for us to move forward, and understanding how these pieces and how we all played a role within how things are currently and how we can together collectively move forward. And I think the museum has been a great space for that. And also it's been one of the, I think museums and typically are spaces where people come for that kind of reflection, perspective changing. And so it was the perfect place, and I found great reception with the Museum of Vancouver as being a space to hold those type of conversations and to amplify the experience of people of African descent in Vancouver, and them making it intentionally something that they want to do in a way that's authentic, in a way that brings other people who have lived experiences and diverse experiences into the room to participate in the process of developing what that looks like.
Let's talk more about space and spaces. Do you have a favorite place or space in Vancouver?
Interesting. I think I'm a space file. I love space. We have a program called Black Spaces Symposium, and we talk about different spaces and how we can utilize those spaces and how to promote specifically African descent culture in diverse spaces and how that looks like and how we can imagine that. I think my favorite space, I'd say probably the garden spaces are probably my favorite spaces, just because nature is welcoming to everyone. Everyone can show up. Everyone can find themselves in nature. Everyone can learn. I think it's like a grand unifying, it is the space. It is the place where we can come together and ground ourselves. And everyone is, I know, differently affected by the space, but everyone collectively can be like, we feel something. And so I think like amplifying natural spaces is important. But I really, besides a physical space, I do really like, to be honest, not just, I do like the Vancouver Museum. I think it's very cool. I do also like the Vancouver Public Library. I think it's great. I think the art gallery is really great downtown as well. And yeah, I think there's a few other spaces, but they're the top of mind. I think those are kind of the three that come to mind.
There's a few things I pull out of there. One is, you know, a few of the spaces you mentioned are those institutional spaces, mm-hmm. and that really speaks to the importance of making sure that those spaces are for everyone and reflective of the actual, the wide diversity of people that make up this place mm-hmm. and use these places.
Mm-hmm. Right? I think it's so important because they're kind of the pillar foundational spaces in the city. And so if these are the core of the city and you don't see yourself or you aren't reflected in, if you walk through the halls and you don't see people that are working there or actively participating in programming and developing, it really does affect the way you see what's possible for yourself. And again, does affect retention. I typically like to go places where I know I'm going to be welcome, as everyone does. And so it's like, how do we intentionally support people and make them know that we are open and supportive to them if we don't see them in the space? And I think definitely that's something that the city of Vancouver in general is working on, trying to expand and trying to get into the understanding of what are the barriers. And I think that when we start to have those type of conversations, we can actually hopefully get to some solutions and hopefully change the experience for other people who may not feel so welcome, and hopefully begin to create a history, a future that actually is more inclusive.
The other thing was just the garden piece. Mm-hmm. And I think it is really interesting how much you can learn about both how similar we all are, but also just like about individual cultures and everything, just based on what you're planting, what you're harvesting, how you're doing those things, what you're using them for, and all of that.
Exactly. The ecosystem. You see the diversity in real time and how everything supports one another. There's nothing that's wasted in a natural space, in a garden. Everything has a purpose. Everything has a value. And so when you just take that and you flip it and you look at us as human beings, as a community, you know, to me, everyone has value and everyone can be supported and everyone can support. And I think that the ideal reflection of what nature offers is a clear example of that actually being a real thing. And I think that the gift of community is through this community work and through working in the garden, you can also learn about what your strengths are. And you can also be, it can be reflected back to you. And you can also find other things in space that reflect, you know, elements that you may want to embody, you know, which has been really, really cool. And one of the things for me is definitely initially was patience and understanding how much control I actually have over things that are happening, whether it be in my life or other people's lives, which has definitely grounded me and centered me in the point of being like, okay, my responsibility here is to be a steward of the space. And as a steward of the space, what is it to be doing? Pruning, watering, and maintaining the soil. The rest of the sun is not my business. Whether it rains is not my business. You know, there's so many things. So, but it's understanding that it's a collective conversation, collectively working. And also when you take that perspective, like you said, and you put it to problems, you realize that it's not up to me to solve this problem. It's not, this space issue isn't just my issue. It's a collective community issue. Maybe some people in the community don't know that it's an issue. So how do we inspire people? And I think part of the garden, using it as a point of where we not only talk about food security, but also history and also community, gives people a touch point where there's like multiple conversations happening at the same time, very similar to nature's design, natural design, where you can look at something and be inspired by something and learn something all simultaneously. And that's kind of definitely the goal of kind of interrupting people's day-to-day lives and maybe providing them something that they didn't know about their own community or something that can inspire them to be active in their community and maybe hopefully create something intentional that they believe in and that could inspire somebody to do the same.
Yeah, teaching through metaphor or allegory is so effective. Mm-hmm. And being able to show, like, yeah, the interdependence of a garden or a natural ecosystem and all that is mm-hmm. really interesting.
Yeah, typically, honestly, that foundational wisdom, yeah, it governs my understanding. And within everything, I kind of look at a natural perspective. It's like, oh, well, what control do I actually have right now? And I center on that. And then anything else that's not in that, I release. And it really has, even for my mental health, has supported me immensely. Mm-hmm. Because then I'm more empowered with what I have control over, and what I don't have control over, I can surrender it. And I can allow it in the sense of, like, the harvest. I did all that I can do, and this is what we got from it.
Yeah, hoping that's, for more.
Yeah, hoping for next year. Next year we'll learn. What did we learn? What did we didn't learn? What worked? What didn't work? And so it definitely allows you to have definitely like a more graceful approach. And then also you can share that grace to your community and other people. It's like, you know, a lot of the things that we're talking about truth, reconciliation, reclaiming land, reclaiming space, sovereignty, all of these things are really huge, large concepts that sometimes certain communities, because of our positionality, have been thinking of these things a lot longer than others have. But that doesn't diminish the fact that other people need to become aware of these same things. And so understanding that, again, some things bloom earlier than others, you know, it doesn't marginalize the process. Everything is moving as it should in accordance. And just trusting that, you know, by providing spaces and becoming aware of that this space helped me bloom, then let me offer that back into community and maybe I could do something for somebody else in the form of succession or evolution or expansion.
It's a really good look into sort of your philosophy and the way you're approaching this. I'm talking to you today specifically because of the Black History walking tour and tasting. What can you tell me about that? What can people expect?
I think it's going to be a really cool event. So we are talking about food. Heritage Week this year is about culture and specific cultural cuisine. And so we have two amazing food curators and chefs. One who's Alba Patties. They come from Caribbean descent. And then we have Kisha Mama, who is, her family is from America as well as Caribbean descent. So we have a range of soul food as well as Caribbean food. And there's going to be flavors and spices. Some of the things that we grow in the garden will be cooked. Obviously, it's winter right now. So just in theory, the things that we do grow, at least the things we talk about, you'll be able to get a taste of. We'll be talking about key figures within BC Black history, as well as talking about key figures in agriculture and people who help foundationally support in the structure of what we now know as British Columbia. I think it's also important to note that when we talk about the history of people of African descent, we understand that a lot of people that came here came under duress as chattel slaves through transatlantic slave trade, so their energy and their time and labor were stolen. So it's a mixed history of being a stolen person on stolen land, but we do want to recognize the fact that it's important to honor the laws and the governance that existed here from the Indigenous communities. And so finding a way to mirror and talk about both histories in a way showing the collective understanding of what hopefully the future can be and also the lived experiences of people of African descent on these lands.
A lot of the time when talking about Vancouver's Black history, the discussion is centered around Hogan's Alley.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a conscious choice to have the walking tour in a different part of the city? Is that just sort of geographical coincidence?
It's a little bit of both. I think one of the things with when you think about the gardens here in Kitsilano, I think Black history and African history is everyone's, and it doesn't have to be sequestered to a particular space. I think Black spaces are everywhere. Culture spaces are everywhere. And I think that the beauty is finding a way that how can we culturally dress and offer information in ways that's sustainable. And I think sometimes putting the weight in just one particular part of the city actually does erase the conversation, because some people may not be able to ever get to that part of the city to even know if that history exists. So finding ways to integrate through community and create, whether it be gardens or monuments or spaces that can tell the story, I think allow people to realize that, hey, wait a minute, like, yes, people of African descent ended up in Hogan's Alley, but they didn't start there. And I think that there's also histories of redlining, there's histories of segregation, histories of suppression of where Black bodies could be. Realistically, in a world where there was, let's say, a utopia, we would be everywhere. And we wouldn't be sequestered. So our stories and our names and our history would be more expansive than what it currently is. I think the work that Hogan's Alley is doing is amazing. I think that's an important, impactful work. But also expanding the conversation, understanding that Black spaces are everywhere. And I think that they should be all over the Lower Mainland. Like, there should be accessible points for all, whether it be the Asian community, whether it be the South Asian community, I think it's or Southern community. I think history needs to be accessible. And when it's not, it's easily forgotten.
Can you pull, like, a highlight from the tour, or, like, one thing that you particularly like sharing with people?
One thing I particularly like sharing, I think that sometimes when I talk about the fact that it was something that took me years to know, that literally 800 freed slaves from the San Francisco area migrated from the San Francisco area into the Vancouver Island in 1858 is something that initially I did not even think of, because of the erasure and what happened subsequently when they came up here. But understanding that there was foundational presence of people of African descent that had an impact within the structure of what we see today, and who helped bring whether it be agricultural practices, religious institutions, just ways of being supporting foundationally dominant protective associations, whether it be the African Rifles, you start to realize, like, oh, wow, that this is not new. This is not, like, my presence in this space is not new. My desire to implement and be in community and add value in community is not something that's new. And I think that when you learn the history of those that came before you, it empowers you to be like, hey, what can I add? And you also learn that, wow, some of these people were literally amazing. So you mean that you ran away from slavery from Missouri all the way crossing to California, then starting your whole life there, being persecuted there, and then migrating again into another community in another country, and then building again, and then migrating again. It's like, how many lives? Like, you know, like, literally. And it's just like, wow, okay, I'm complaining about what? I'm allowing what to affect me? And I think that type of level of resilience and that level of determination to believe that you deserve to have access to live and to express and to grow, and that desire to seek those spaces was so strong that it motivated them to keep moving and keep pushing. I think those are the type of things that I embody, and I think that hopefully you want to share ultimately with everyone that adversity is something in this life that we may not choose when we're going to experience it, but we can definitely choose to persevere through it, to live through it, to walk through it, to push through it, and to find some level of joy and to find some level of reverence for ourselves and our community along the way.
Yeah, and to do all that in the 1800s, when it's like, you're not taking a flight, you're not taking even a train, right?
Yeah, you're on boat. Like, how are you, like, all is, I was tired for you. Like, and that's just the traveling in between. That's not even the persecution. That's not even, like, the day-to-day life of the mindset that you have to put yourself in. People seeing you as less than human, not even recognizing your value as a person. These are still things that people today are experiencing. And I think that we don't want to speak about slavery as it's something in the distant past, because people are experiencing similar type of experiences, not to the varying degree, but in the sense that there's still an occupation on human bodies, there's still an occupation of space, and so none of us are free until all of us are free. And so I think looking at these histories and understanding these stories just teaches you the resilience and the importance to hold on to what you deserve, which is your inalienable right to seek for freedom and to stand for what you believe in.
Thanks again to Court Case for chatting with me. You can still sign up for the BC Heritage Week Black History Tour and Tasting at vanmaritime.com, VanMaritime.com, vanmaritime.com. Tickets are $25. That gets you the walking tour and the tasting, which seems really cool, and you should check it out. And that happens at the Museum of Vancouver, out in Kitts. All right, we are getting towards the end of the hour here of Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. So let's hear a little bit more music. This is also local, and it's by Jody Glenham, and it's called Overtime. We'll be right back.
This is Towers, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC. Diverse, independent, yours.
This is Bird Note. Barnacle geese are stunning birds. Their feathers are boldly patterned in black, white, and silver. In Europe, huge flocks gather in pastures and mudflats where the geese feast on grasses and moss, but not barnacles. So where did they get that name? The answer harkens back to a medieval myth. Barnacle geese have wintered in the British Isles for millennia. People from the Middle Ages observed that adult birds would turn up in autumn, then vanish come spring. Since locals never found them with goslings or eggs, they scoured land and sea for an explanation of how the geese reproduced. What they found were barnacles, ones that have a large white shell attached to a long gray stalk. To early naturalists, these barnacles looked suspiciously like a bird egg growing from a gooseneck. Putting two and two together, great minds deduced that the mysterious birds must hatch from barnacles. Modern science eventually debunked the myth that geese spontaneously generate from marine crustaceans. They migrate to the Arctic to breed, but the name stuck. So even today, barnacle geese tell a tale as old as medieval times. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at supportblackcharities.org.